Greetings, this is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia, and this is an audio version of a book review that I have written. The book under review is by Elijah Hickson and Peter J. Gurry, who served as the editors. The book's title is Myths and Mistakes in New Testament Textual Criticism. It was published by InterVarsity Press in 2019, and it is 372 pages in length. My review of this book first appeared in the Puritan Reformed Journal, Volume 14, Number 1, January 2022, and it can be found on pages 166 to 172. Here now is the review. Hickson and Gurry are evangelical scholars with PhD degrees in textual criticism from British universities, Edinburgh and Cambridge, respectively. Hickson now serves on the pastoral staff of Fireside Fellowship, SBC Church, in Kingston, Tennessee. Gurry teaches New Testament at Phoenix Seminary. In the introduction, they note that they conceived of this work to help correct outdated and inaccurate facts and details related to the text of the New Testament, as circulated by popular apologists and scholars alike. After the initial introduction by the editors, Chapter 1, the work consists of 14 content chapters, each written by a different author, covering various topics related to the field of New Testament textual criticism. What follows is a brief summary of each chapter, followed by an analysis of this work. Chapter 2 is entitled Myths About Autographs and is written by Timothy N. Mitchell. Mitchell says the concept of the autograph is best defined as, quote, the completed authorial work, end quote, released by the author, quote, for circulation and copying, end quote, page 39. He also opposes recent claims by Craig A. Evans that the New Testament autographs lasted hundreds of years and that they probably stabilized the textual transmission, see page 46. Chapter 3, Math Myths, is written by Jacob W. Peterson. It addresses the question of the actual number of extant Greek New Testament manuscripts. Peterson suggests the most realistic estimate to be around 5,100 to 5,300. Of these, 83% come from the year 1,000 or later. The earliest are, quote, typically fragmentary and few in number, end quote, page 48. There are only 138 cataloged papyri and, at best, quote, between 261 and 282 majuscules, end quote, page 58. Only about 60 manuscripts have the entire New Testament. Quote, this leaves the other 99% containing only portions of the text, end quote, page 63. Peterson concludes, quote, bigger numbers do not necessarily equate to better evidence, end quote, page 67. In chapter 4, Myths About Classical Literature, James B. Prothrow points out that Christian apologists have tended inaccurately and unfairly to compare the number of extant New Testament manuscripts with the number of extant manuscripts of secular classical works by Greek and Roman authors. They've also tended to use now outdated information gleaned from scholars like F.F. Bruce. Greater accuracy and circumspection are urged when making such comparisons. Chapter 5, Dating Myths, Part 1, is by Elijah Hickson, who argues a survey of various methods used to date manuscripts demonstrates that precision in dating is not always possible. Hickson calls attention to recent challenges by Brent Nongbri and others to the early dating of P52 to around AD 125. Apologists should avoid using so-called sensational early dates for New Testament manuscripts. Any date from the first century is, according to Hickson, an immediate red flag. See page 108. Chapter 6 is Dating Myths, Part 2, by Gregory R. Lanier. Lanier's rather ambivalent key point is that, quote, sometimes later manuscripts are better manuscripts but not always, end quote. Pages 111 to 112. A late manuscript might well have derived from a much older manuscript. A distinction must be made between the age of a manuscript and the text it contains. He also notes a growing appreciation in recent scholarship for the Byzantine tradition, while also suggesting this approach may have shortcomings. Chapter 7, Myths About Copyists, is written by Zachary J. Cole, who asks whether early Christian copyists were zealous amateurs or careful professionals or somewhere in between. See page 133. He concludes that while not all may have been professionals, quote, most were competent and experienced, end quote, page 139. While conceding that material evidence from the 2nd and 3rd centuries is fragmentary, and for the 1st century, non-existent. See page 144. Chapter 8 is Myths About Copying by Peter Malick. Malick argues that early scribes did not generally seek to introduce intentional innovations to the text, but they made mistakes by accident. He then suggests that later corrections to early manuscripts, quote, constitute an important piece in the puzzle of transmission history, end quote, page 153. He cites P66 as an example of a manuscript which had many initial mistakes, but its corrections reveal a concern for accuracy. Chapter 9 is Myths About Transmission by S. Matthew Solomon. This chapter provides a discussion of New Testament textual transmission using the Collation of Philemon as an example. Though current handbooks list only a few variants for Philemon, there are in fact hundreds in the roundabout 335 words of the epistle, see page 172. In fact, Solomon says, quote, almost every word, end quote, in Philemon is included in, quote, a variation unit, end quote, page 183. There are few early witnesses to Philemon. Only 23 of over 700 manuscripts of Philemon are dated earlier than AD 900. Solomon's conclusion, quote, the question of the text in the New Testament is not settled. More research and analysis needs to be completed, end quote, page 189. Chapter 10 is Myths About Variants by Peter J. Gurry, who tackles two key questions. First, how many variants are there in the New Testament? Second, do these variants affect doctrine? In response to the first question, he concludes, quote, it is probably best to leave it as around 500,000 non-spelling variants in our Greek manuscripts, end quote, page 194. In response to the second question, Gurry concedes that contrary to the claims of many apologists, the New Testament variants do, in fact, affect doctrine. He gives three examples, Mark 1:1, Luke 23:34, and John 1:18. He concludes it is best to admit that variants which affect doctrine occur, quote, in relatively rare cases, end quote, but doubles down by insisting that no doctrines or ethical practices of the faith are, quote, established from these disputed texts, end quote, page 209. Robert D. Marcello authored chapter 11, Myths About Orthodox Corruptions. This chapter addresses the notion promoted by Bart Ehrman that it was the Orthodox scribes who corrupted the New Testament text. Though critical of some aspects of Ehrman's approach, interestingly enough, Marcello concedes that Ehrman's, quote, central thesis, end quote, regarding Orthodox corruptions, quote, within the manuscript tradition remains true, end quote, page 219. Andrew Blaski wrote chapter 12, Myths About Patristics. The author begins focusing on a long-standing and oft-repeated myth, suggesting that practically the entire New Testament can be reconstructed based on extant patristic citations alone. He traces the origins of this supposition to an anecdote shared in an 1841 book by Scottish author Robert Philip, and then proceeds to debunk the claim as unsubstantiated. He stresses the weakness of reliance on patristic citations for New Testament reconstruction since, quote, the mental divide was not as great between text and interpreter, end quote, for early writers, allowing them to be, quote, more free and even playful with the text itself, end quote, page 239. Chapter 13 is Myths About Canon by John D. Mead. Mead examines the suggestion that early Christian adaptation of the Codex, quote, caused the concept of canon to become more concrete, end quote, page 253. He first examines the 18 extant early canon lists, concluding there was a general consensus by the second century as to the canonical books. The Codex, then, quote, did not serve to demarcate the Christian canon, nor did it help it develop in any notable way, end quote, page 262. He cites research calling to question the idea that New Testament works, like the four Gospels, commonly circulated together in codices until the patristic period. Mead then examines the, quote, early pandex, end quote, or, quote, megacodices, end quote, on pages 270 to 274, especially focusing on Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus. Such works allowed for the inclusion of non-canonical works like 1st and 2nd Clement or the Shepherd of Hermas. Thus, he concludes that the canon list, not the codex, was key for establishing canonical boundaries. Chapter 14 is Myths About Early Translations by Jeremiah Coogan. The author does not make any novel claim, but offers a summary of the current state of scholarship on the versions, noting three chronological categories: the earliest and most important, Latin, Syriac, and Coptic; those completed by the late 4th century, Gothic, Ethiopic, and Armenian; and those of late antiquity and the early Middle Ages, Georgian, Slavonic, Christian, Palestinian, Aramaic, and Arabic. Coogan makes this intriguing observation regarding the Latin manuscripts, quote, "We have no reliable estimate of the total number," end quote, page 288. He concludes that these translations, quote, "are not simply witnesses for reconstructing the text," end quote, but, quote, "windows into how the early church studied, prayed, and worshipped," end quote, page 303. Finally, chapter 15 is Myths About Modern Translations by Edgar Batad Ebojo. The author points out that the concern of modern textual critics and modern translators are not always the same. Modern critics doubt, for example, the authenticity of John 7:53 through 8:11, but almost all translations place it in the text, even if with notes, showing, quote, "the tenacity of this tradition in the global translation history," end quote, page 312. He adds that translations and their notes can, in the end, only convey textual information in what he calls a limited way. See page 323. Let's move on to analysis. The editors make clear from the outset that this work is neither meant to serve as a general introduction to New Testament textual criticism, nor as the so-called last word on the subject. It does, however, provide a valuable survey of important issues related to the current state of modern academic textual criticism. It will undoubtedly help evangelical apologists, pastors, and scholars avoid making erroneous, misleading, or exaggerated claims about the text of the New Testament. Though substantial, the work is not exhaustive. There are some significant and often repeated historical myths circulating in the field of textual criticism not addressed in this work. A chapter might have been added, for example, titled Myths About Erasmus, to debunk misleading historical anecdotes which have circulated about Erasmus since the 19th century. For example, that he rushed his 1516 Greek New Testament into print, or he only included the Johannine Coma after making a so-called rash wager. The work is also at points uneven in its treatment of some theological issues. On one hand, we can be thankful that Gurry rejects the myth that textual variants do not affect doctrine, but he then almost immediately doubles down on the same claim by asserting that no key theological or ethical points rest on the affirmation of any variant. He does not seem to grasp the point that a challenge to the text of Scripture is inherently a challenge to many wider aspects of bibliology, including the authority, integrity, canonicity, sufficiency, and preservation of Scripture. Gurry also fails to understand some of the more nuanced aspects of the variants he discusses. For example, he seems unaware of challenges represented by the modern text and translation of John 1:18 with respect to the doctrine of the eternal generation of the Son, which Charles Lee Irons has called, quote, a crucial linchpin for the pro-Nicene doctrine of the Trinity, end quote. The book only lightly addresses some of the key theological challenges posed by current shifts in modern textual criticism, including its abandonment of the so-called old goal of reconstructing the original autograph with the so-called new goal of simply establishing an, quote, initial text, end quote. Perhaps a chapter titled Myths About Reconstructing the Autograph could have been added. In the introduction, the editors affirm, quote, we believe the textual evidence we have is sufficient to reconstruct, in most cases, what the authors of the New Testament wrote, end quote, page 20. If one can only do this, quote, in most cases, end quote, however, this means one cannot do so in all cases. Furthermore, the determination of which parts of the New Testament can be reliably reconstructed and which parts remain unsure appears to rest on the arbitrary judgments of the critics. After admitting that the text cannot be reconstructed with equal certainty in every case, the editors add, quote, nor do we think that God has preserved the original text of the New Testament equally well at every point in history or at every place in the world, end quote, page 20. This represents a novel reinterpretation of the classic Protestant doctrine of the providential preservation of Scripture as kept pure in all ages. Compare the Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 1 and paragraph 8. The editors contend that God has preserved not the texts of Scripture, but only the core Christian concepts within the text. They write, quote, in every age, God has given his people a text that is more than reliable enough to know the saving work he has accomplished through Jesus Christ, end quote, page 20. Such a perspective does not seem compatible, however, with the classic confessional Protestant view of preservation. The articles in this collection reflect at numerous points the inroads of relativism and epistemological uncertainty with respect to the text of Scripture. The radical skepticism of Ehrman appears to rule the day. Here are some examples. In Solomon's chapter on transmission, he emphasizes that, quote, every single handwritten copy of the Bible was someone's Bible, end quote. See pages 172 and 173. The implication is that there are no wrong or inaccurate readings. All are valid. He later adds that when it comes to variants, quote, which reading is original really does not matter for interpretation, end quote, since it supposedly did not matter for early Christians, and, quote, we cannot hold ancient manuscript culture to the same standard as our modern print culture, end quote, page 189. The text is therefore unsettled and will seemingly always require more research and analysis. As noted above, Marcello concedes that Ehrman is essentially right about orthodox corruptions of the text, see page 219. Coogan asserts that ancient versions are less useful for reconstructing the text than they are for providing what he calls windows, in an echo of Ehrman, into early Christianity. This overall uncertainty as to the possibility of determining the text is perhaps most clearly articulated by Daniel B. Wallace in his foreword to the work. Wallace begins with the unsettling claim that, quote, we do not have now in our critical Greek texts or any translations exactly what the authors of the New Testament wrote. Even if we did, we would not know it, end quote, page Roman numeral 12. He proceeds to note that the so-called new generation of evangelical scholars, quote, is far more comfortable with ambiguity and uncertainty than previous generations, end quote, page Roman numeral 12. They embrace, quote, absolute truth, end quote, but not, quote, absolute certainty, end quote, page Roman numeral 12. He praises the editors for their insistence, quote, that it is neither necessary nor even possible to demonstrate that we can recover the exact wording of the New Testament. But what we have is good enough, end quote, page Roman numeral 20. This seems far afield from the classic Protestant views of men like Thomas Manton, John Owen, or Francis Turretin. It risks undermining confidence and trust in the integrity and authority of Scripture. This book will certainly prove a helpful resource in aiding us to speak truthfully and accurately about the extant manuscript evidence and methods used in modern textual criticism. The editors and authors have perhaps also inadvertently provided us with at least equally valuable information and insights into the doctrinal challenges and inconsistencies that arise for evangelicals who embrace this approach to the text of Scripture. Is it, in the end, a myth that confessional men can embrace the modern method of textual criticism, and is it a mistake for them to do so? Here ends the review. You can find audiobook reviews and notes like this one, Word Magazine podcasts, and sermons by subscribing to Christ Reformed Baptist Church's sermon audio feed on iTunes by searching for Christ Reformed Baptist Church. For video material, you can subscribe to the Word Magazine channel on YouTube.com. You can also find written book reviews, notes, and articles on my blog at jeffriddle.net. And you can follow me on Twitter at Riddle1689.